Hello, welcome to the Sprocket Podcast, where I am weaning Aaron off of his script, slowly but surely. My name is Brock Dittus. This is where we are simplifying the good life. Did I say that already?
No.
Okay.
You just said it.
Okay. Really. Welcome to the podcast.
And I'm Aaron Flores. We are broadcasting from the People's Republic of Portland, nestled in the heart of Cascadia.
We are the show that brings you somewhat irreverent conversations about the intricacies of thinking locally with a global perspective and enjoying the best that life has to offer along the way.
Covering day-to-day life, food, alcohol, bicycles, and alternative transportation, weaning me off the show notes. Man, this was worse than trying to quit sniffing glue.
Seriously, picked the wrong day.
Yeah. Technology and the internet. No, that's not right.
Oh,
something
okay.
And the internet. And
yeah.
And other things. And
things
more,
and stuff.
Some more things.
Yeah.
And
we talk about a lot of things. I'm curious. We're also in the room with Rob Sadowski from the BTA, returning perennial guest. Is this the fourth time you've been here?
Yeah.
I think. Okay. Yeah.
Holy
yeah.
Shit.
So, yeah. You're basically another co-host at this point.
Excellent.
And Michael Tetta.
Yeah.
From the Community Cycling Center. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right. I was just going to say, Rob, you've probably watched us degrade our professionality from the first time you joined us until now. I think we continue to relax and unwind.
And now so. We have relaxed too much.
I don't know if we can get more degraded than the than our sausage show.
It's true. We did spend an entire show talking about Rob making sausage, which it was fascinating. It can be done.
So. You can find it in the archive, right?
That's right. It's way back there. Yeah. And Michael, you're from the Community Cycling Center. You're recently CEO. Is that the term?
That's the official designation.
Okay,
yes.
Cool. I was just doing internet research. I was trying to figure out if you were if there were other letters that went along with your name. I was trying to figure out the way to present you properly.
Yeah, not so, PhD. Don't have a master's in science or anything else, actually.
All right. Easy enough. Well, we're going to talk about all things Community Cycling Center in just a tad. So thank you both for coming in and joining us. Some of us are enjoying some yerba mate, which is your beverage of choice, as I understand.
That's right.
Yeah. And you're on the classic gold, is that it?
I'm on the classic gold, yeah.
Yeah. Mate, as we were just talking about how it has really good pick-me-up qualities without any of the buzz, without the freneticism of coffee. So we'll all be awake. We'll all be alert for this. And yet, we will not be
not
scattered.
Not jittery.
Well,
hopefully.
We hope.
Yeah.
I don't know. I may not be able to be stopped. But welcome again to the show. I have really cool news. This week, I traded my tall bike for a cargo bike. Not permanently. Not permanently. But listener Drew, who I think we read part of his mail last week, he had written in and said, hey, here are some things for the show. Oh, and by the way, I'm thinking about getting a tall bike, and I don't want to build one or buy one or whatever until I can try it out and see if I can actually ride one. And so, hey, would you be interested in loaning me yours? I'll trade you a sweet front loader Bach Feets. So I've been riding that for the past 2 days.
And
it's been a lot of fun.
How do you like the front loader?
It's kind of cool. It feels... I'm trying to think of how you describe it. The interesting thing about the physics of turning a Bach feet is that when you turn the wheel, the entire bike swings in front of you one way or the other, as opposed to usually if you're riding your typical bicycle, you'll be like kind of hovering over the front wheel. And so basically you turn with that front wheel.
Right.
And you don't think much about the rest of the bike. But the cargo bike has all that length out in front. And it just kind of swings almost as though you were on a hinge. So the turns are interesting.
Driving a TriMet bus is very similar.
Yeah. Yeah, actually it is. Yeah.
Have you driven a TriMet bus, Rob?
I have. I was on this TriMet safety committee, and they had every committee member go on the training yard driving it. They wouldn't let me out there on the real streets with real people.
Yeah.
But I got to brake. I got to turn. It was a great experience.
That's exciting. You know, I'm as interested as I am in your experience with the Bach feet. I'm really interested. Have you heard from listener Drew? Is he doing okay? Did you give him a safety course before you just let him out on this thing?
I gave him some tips, but I think he might have been a little bit like nervous or shy about kind of the trial of the thing. I know I was when I first tried mine, because
sure.
Mine was built by Tom Labonte from Tom's Cargo Bikes. And he built it for me out of the frames I gave him. But then when he brought out like the first draft or whatever, It wasn't painted. It wasn't like all the way done, but he was like, here, try this and see how it feels. And I picked it up. I didn't pick it up. I like put my hands on it and I thought to myself, how do I get onto this? And I had no idea. So yeah, I think I had a very similar experience when I first started. It was just kind of like this, I don't know what to do with this. But yeah, I gave him kind of like the old scooters we had when we were kids. They don't make them like that anymore. I don't think. I haven't seen them. But like a big stand-up scooter with like handlebars.
Oh, yeah. And they had those giant
a big platform. Yeah, and the big inflatable tires as opposed to like the Razor scooters that everybody has these days. I miss those. But that was kind of how I started learning to ride mine because Tom put a little cargo platform on the bottom so you could put your feet in there and kind of stand on it and coast on it. And then once you're comfortable with the weight of the thing swinging back and forth and learning how to control that, then you can actually climb up to the pedals. So... as I understand, listener Drew did, in fact, mount the tall bike the very next day. And I think by the end of the day, he was in full swing.
Like, wonderful.
Yeah. So I'm proud of him. And I think he's got bitten by the bug. The thing that he noticed and I noticed when I go out is that kids love that thing.
Wow. Oh, yeah.
Because we see the closer you get to Central City, Portland, the more you will find people who are building tall bikes, but also like the less remarkable they want to be in some ways. Like the person with the tall bike in the middle of the city is going to be probably miffled or annoyed if you make too much of their tall bike. Like, what are you looking at? Don't look at me.
Which is funny because they're on a tall bike.
Right, which is an action saying, look at me.
Right.
So the thing I noticed when I lived farther out and I used to live out like 92nd and Flavel out in the Lentz area. And nobody has one out there. So whenever I'd ride it, it always felt very unique and very novel. And kids would point and stare and be like, how did you get up on that thing? And then how do you get down was
how
the other question,
down?
Which Aaron helped me answer, which is you just do a little dance and be like this and dance around. Which is a dumb joke, and yet it's very funny to me. It amuses me.
I think it's hilarious.
I think it amuses me because I don't think the kids get it for sure.
No, certainly not.
But yeah. So, anyways, that's happy riding, Drew, and I'm both looking forward to getting my bike back from Velocult because it needs to be fixed.
Have you seen the Onion piece about the? In play with the whole Congress shutdown and where it did a piece on half the funk crowd was get down to get up and the other half was fighting for get up to get down. It's a really brilliant piece.
I have not seen this. That's fantastic. Yeah. Well, so many ways to attack that problem.
Yeah.
And which place do you start in and which place do you end? Yeah. No, my bike is messed up.
What'd you do to it?
I rode it for like 6 months. Oh. it's in need of regular maintenance.
Oh, okay.
I'm bad at doing that on time. So by the time I took my bike into the shop, it had like the bottom bracket was a little bit wiggly. The pedals were wiggling in ways that they shouldn't, which I was concerned about. So
you
we don't know the verdict.
You regularly replace those parts though, don't you?
Kind of. Yeah.
Yeah. You're pretty hard on that.
Yeah. Sky at Velocult nicknamed me the parts destroyer because, every time I come in, like my bike has like multiple things that need to be replaced. So.
Yeah, you're going to need to get that either on some kind of a jean jacket or a vest or something because you can't just let that go unadorned.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's
I
true.
Do like the jean jacket idea. That would be a...
Or a jean jacket or a cape, vest, anyways.
A cape, that's a superhero.
Yeah, PD.
Parts destroyer.
Aaron, anything happened to you?
Nothing terribly significant. It's getting darker and I'm realizing I need lights.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got the required, you know, front and back light, which I guess the back is not required, right?
That's correct. You either need a light or a reflector. Reflector is fine in the state of Oregon.
Right on.
If you're listening outside the state of Oregon, check your local laws.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah.
But, I also wear all black. And
that you do.
Yeah. And it's getting darker a lot quicker.
Yeah.
These days.
Daylight savings time, which throws everybody for a loop. I was just commenting that this is the first show we've done this year in which it is dark before we start taping.
Wow.
I got a phone call this afternoon from a woman who says, hi, can you give me some advice about riding at night? And I'm said, sure. And do you have anything specific? And she wanted me to tell her what streets she should ride on and what streets she shouldn't ride on.
All of them.
Yeah. It was really quite
especially the Markham Bridge.
Yes. Have you tried the Markham Bridge?
That one's great at night.
You'll be well seen.
It's pretty well lit over there.
Yeah. So what's your idea, Aaron? Do you have, are you going to have an array?
Here's the thing.
Are you going to have like a full, like,
I don't want to be that guy, but I'm going to have to be that guy.
I think you could do it.
Everything, like every light imaginable
on
their bike. Cause yeah, I've just had too many close calls in just the past 2 days, you know, where I think it's been most noticeable how quickly it's been getting dark.
Mm. Before you expect it.
Yeah.
And, sneaks up on you.
And I'm pretty confident in my riding, and so I'll ride along Hawthorne and other busy streets like that without too much trouble. But yeah, I had a few close calls, and realizing it's really, they've all been from the side too. So it's, and I can tell.
Do you have any like side reflectors?
I've got reflective sidewalls and reflective tape on my fork, on the sides of my fork, but apparently not good enough.
Where do you have your front light mounted?
On the bars?
Yeah. I find that if you mount the light on your helmet, then as you see traffic arriving at intersections, you can point your shining light of safety in any direction, right, that you need, and it can get the attention of cars that are out on the road.
Yes, and that would require me wearing a helmet, which,
oh,
you know,
pardon my
assumption. I hate to sound like a sellout. Well, in these past few days, I have started adorning a helmet again.
There we go.
You could always strap a light on your head too.
That's true. But, yeah. Just one of those camper.
Yeah, just a headlamp. Yeah.
Like a miner.
Yeah.
A miner with a lantern.
Yeah, exactly.
With a candle mirror focused on that.
You could even have
that would be so Portland.
Like hold it up with your hand.
Such a Portland thing.
Was it? There was a Pedalpalooza ride that was just, it was a, was like there? A Luddite ride.
Oh, yeah,
that
right.
Said
that's
like,
right.
I wanted to do that.
You, really?
Yeah. And it was at night, of course. And so, and you couldn't bring your electrical lights. You had to figure out some way. I guess the DynaHub would be one way to get around that, but I get, according to the description, like you were supposed to have like a lantern of some kind.
Okay. Because in what, in Great Britain, they call it a torch?
Correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's
also a flashlight is a torch too.
Right, right. You can tell who the Luddites are because when you go out at night, the Luddites have fire and the other people have like actual that's electronic light. Yeah. Man. I would like to have seen that.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, me too.
I just like the idea of being a Luddite anyways. I mean, obviously I'm not because like look around the apartment and see all the machines that are
look
here.
At all this electricity that it's we're using.
Yeah. But I like the idea at least of like trying to figure out how to use old things, old timey things like a lantern that you hold in your hand. So, all right. Well, good luck getting lit.
Yeah.
As they say.
I think my dream is to get one of those spoke lights, those set of spoke lights, and you know, have messages that you can relay.
Perfect.
On those. Yeah. I'll start with please don't hit me.
There we go.
I think that would be a good one.
And then on the other side could say thank you for not hitting me.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, and then they got those other ones that just look like Tron lights too, and there's like a white one on the front and a black one on the back, and it's just like Blade Runner style. It's really
sick. You leave like a trail behind you and other bikes crash into it.
Ooh,
that's Tron right there. There was the one dude that Bike Portland, I think, found a guy who was like
all dressed in Tron gear.
He was a BMX trick rider that basically it was a Tron outfit. And he had lights.
I have to look up that
blue.
Article now.
Yeah, no, that was damn cool.
This was his
cool.
Everyday getup.
At least for his act, I think his. I don't know if it was a job, like as in someone else was paying him for it, but he was like getting sponsorships and riding and going to events and stuff, and so he put a lot of time into being the Tron guy. I've never seen him outside of his act looking like someone from the movie.
He could be in this room right now.
Well, that's true. Yeah. It would have to, oh man, I was going to drop a reference, but I can't remember my terminology. Be derezzed by what is it? What are the big things that fly around? I forget. All right.
Nope. You lost me.
We like these things, but we don't know these things. It's okay.
Hey, speaking of not being a Luddite.
Yeah.
I bought a new computer.
Oh, congratulations.
Yes.
You got another Linux machine, right?
I did, yeah. From the good people of Free Geek.
Okay. Free Geek, I like what they do.
I do.
We need to pull them in here someday.
I love those people. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that'd be so great.
Because they're all about recycling stuff, basically. Like, take a computer and give it new life.
Yeah, it's like technology and simplicity, you know, sort of
hand in hand. Yeah.
Well, they're like the community cycling center of technology.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, we're like the Free Geek of bicycles or something, right?
Right.
You guys should each make patches. Ooh. For each other.
And then, like, you see a lot of the same things actually play out when you go into Free Geek. Like, they have this amazing kind of play school colored keyboards, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The kid's up at the front counter, and it's like, you can totally not buy this. This is not for sale, so don't even ask me. It's totally our cool stuff.
And oh, when I was like, there, they had, like, all these. Someone had given them these Commodore 64 cartridges.
What?
Yeah, these game cartridges. Yeah, there used to be cartridges that you could plug in.
Oh,
That's the really old school.
Yeah, yeah. And the two people behind the desk are discussing who's going to buy those.
You mean like between the two of them?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they were like for sale.
I gotcha.
If any customer were to come in and buy them, you know, they could have them. But these two people are like, well, I think I want them. No, well, maybe we should both get them and share them.
Well, I will say the thing about the Commodore 64, and this is reaching like way out of our purview probably for the listener's interest, but the music capabilities of the Commodore 64, so much better than that of any other computer of its time.
Wow. You hear that?
The sound.
You hear that technology?
Yeah. Yeah. So anyways, that's all I have to say about that. Well, congratulations. You got a computer. So you'll be online again. You're no longer a Luddite.
It's also, I think, their heaviest laptop that they had in stock.
Did you put it in your bag?
It was in there for a couple hours. And then I, like, normally, you know, I'm around town all day riding around.
Yeah.
This is one of my days off. And I bought this like first thing thinking like, okay, then I'll spend some time at a cafe, dink around and then do some running around and
work on your configs.
Yeah. And then, right. Exactly. Yeah. And then come over here. But the thing was too damn heavy.
Okay.
Spent some time at a cafe, dinked around and then, rode around for a little bit, did a few errands and then realized I got to drop this off.
Okay.
Like, my bag is getting too heavy.
Yeah.
Wow.
And
did you carry it over Tabor?
Oh, hells yeah.
Okay. There we go.
That's still not going to stop.
All right. This will be my transition to you, Michael, because I, my internet research, looking on your little blurb on the Community Cycling Center's website.
Yeah.
It said that you like to ride up Tabor.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. Is that out of all the other buttes and hills about Tabor is the best?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fundamentally, those were formative years for me. And as cheesy as it sounds, that's where my father actually taught me a lot about life.
Yeah.
I actually spent years 0 through 6 on 47th and Belmont, just up the street here.
That's like on the flanks of Tabor.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, we were riding up that thing just about every day after school for months.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. And for weeks on the way up, I cried my little eyes out because trying to ride your bike up there behind your strapping like 26-year-old father on a much bigger bike was just dreadful, you know, and he wasn't hearing anything like complaints. So after, you know, a couple of weeks of crying and making it, I realized I could just subtract the tears and still, have the view. And he was always telling me, you know, life is that way. You got to work really hard, on your way up. And then if you get to a certain place, you may end up finding that you're able to enjoy the view.
I love this.
Holy shit.
I'm going to be thinking about this every other time I go to Tabor from like here on out, actually.
You know, and without going too deep into it, my father immigrated from Ghana in 1981.
Uh-huh.
And part of what I really enjoy and cherish about growing up with him was the fact that he brought a sense of adventure into his day-to-day life because he was recently immigrated that really rubbed off on me and instilled in me a sense that not only was this a really wonderful place full of opportunity, but that, you know, everything was exciting, you know, and every day was a new opportunity to see something new. And that's something that I really cherish.
And seeing it through new eyes, like kind of being able to see something that you've seen all the time as though you were seeing it.
Yeah, like, exactly.
As a new thing. Which, that's great.
Yeah.
Do you know how the bike came to him?
Well, he stole it from my mom.
There we go.
You know, ultimately. And she had like a rad, like 26-inch with the BMX bars. which was relatively ahead of its time. And there was always really awesome bike technology at the house because my brother David actually left town when he was 16 or 17 to go be a bike messenger down in San Francisco.
Oh, wow.
And I remember when he came back to visit one time at 17, we were up on Mount Tabor, and he was doing all of these trials moves up and down the picnic tables and back again, and I was just like blown away, knew that I had to be a part of whatever it was that he was on, and was really addicted to bikes ever since.
Yeah. Did you visit him down there?
No.
No, okay.
No, I was really young at the time.
He would always bring it back here.
And, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
But seeing people do cool things on two wheels.
It's super important for kids to get stoked, whether they're riding a tall bike or they're doing something seemingly impossible.
Exactly.
You know, on just random inanimate objects is really exciting.
Yeah. Do you have any ideas about just thinking about Mount Tabor? I know that the reservoirs that have been there for a long time are no longer the city's water supply.
Right.
Is that sad to see it go away, or do you think it's all right?
You know, I don't know. I haven't been really too connected with that issue. I think it's kind of a majestic place.
It is.
And I know people really enjoy the way the park is, and they really like, I'm sure if it isn't just the feeling that comes from having this wonderful reservoir of water, you know, and I think it's something that we can take for granted in the United States and can certainly take for granted here in the Northwest is the availability of fresh water, you know, and I understand that it's a total security threat and that there's like dead squirrels in there and stuff like that. But I really like the prospect of us finding a way to preserve fresh water supply throughout the city.
Right, right. Well, I know that they're putting in that new reservoir up on Kelly Butte. Is that right? And they're capping that one. And I think Powell Butte is also getting reservoirs.
Intriguing.
I think that was to replace the open air system because there was the guy who like peed into it last year or the year before or something like
From Olala.
Oh, he was he?
Yes.
Okay, well, yes. Now we know why.
I mean, how did that end up even being a story? Was he like consistently peeing in it, or did he pee in it once and get dragged away in handcuffs?
I don't remember what happened.
I do believe it was just a one-time thing.
Yes. Okay. Wow.
Well, don't mess with
They emptied the entire reservoir, and it cost, it was like $40,000.
That sounds
It was
right,
crazy. Yeah, it was a lot of money, and like given how much the average bladder can hold, versus how much water is actually in the reservoir. Like, I can't remember how many parts per million they figured, but it was really small and well within acceptable drinking levels. But it's just the fact that somebody peed in the water, you know?
It's like if you find a hair in your salad at the restaurant, like that hair's not going to hurt you.
The whole salad is
But the whole salad goes, yeah.
Wow.
Well, so it goes, I guess.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, even if we're not drinking the water, I could see it wouldn't be too hard to have some water in there just for peaceful reasons.
Do you know what they're going to do with the space? Once
I haven't heard much about it. No, I gotta look into this.
They're still battling whether they're going to even remove the reservoir. It's there's a whole group of, I think it's like Occupy Tabor that is formed, and it's a real interesting group. It's not like a bunch of young radicals. It's a group of people from Mount Tabor who really care deeply about this issue. And, but it's hard. It's like, what's the message? It's one of those things where are they preserving it for the sake of environmentalism, historic preservation, just love, but it's not really clear. It's hard. I'm following it, but it's hard to pay attention enough because I don't really know why.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and it's one of those stories.
Tomorrow, though.
Someone will tell you. That's what podcasting is all about, I've found, is like you just kind of put your questions, your ignorance out into the world, and someone will come back and give you the answer. So it's like Google, but more organic. Yeah, exactly. So, Michael, you've been into bikes for a long time. What brought you to the Community Cycling Center initially?
Oh, I dropped out of graduate school, and I wanted to get a job at a bike shop.
There you go.
And I went a lot of different places around town, and nobody would really give me the time of day because I didn't have skills and I didn't have any experience. But not only did I get an opportunity to connect with folks at the cycling center, but they actually sat me down for an interview.
Nice.
And I was actually talking to an employee of ours just today, and I guess there's this lore around the fact that I showed up for a basic kind of entry-level retail sales position in a suit and tie.
Uh-huh.
And now that's like some big deal now, and everyone talks about it. Like, you got to show up for the job that you want and all this other kind of stuff. But I was really just trying to get a job at a bike shop, and that was 2005.
Yeah. You had a suit and tie?
Yeah, had a suit and tie, even in 2005.
Well done.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's the sort of thing that can impress. Mm-hmm. I remember wearing suits and ties almost kind of for fun. I think we found some in a box somewhere when I was in college, and we're just like, oh, hey, we'd look sharp if we wore these. But I don't think I've ever actually been to a job interview with a suit and tie.
Wow.
I'll have to do that.
Yeah, well,
if I ever need an interview
just
again.
Just for the sake of it, start applying for jobs so that you can have that experience.
just interview.
I've had this idea that I would apply for jobs with a fake resume saying that I worked for some made-up company or a company that actually exists, like Dunder Mifflin, and see if I can get an interview and then test that out. Yeah, no, before I came to Portland, I had to wear suit and ties like at a variety of meetings. The only time I dress up is if I'm meeting with the mayor. Mm-hmm. And that's rare too, because I know that it probably doesn't matter that much to him.
Right.
But I was taught a long time probably by my parents that you dress up a little better than the person you think you're meeting with, because you want to show them that respect. Mm-hmm. It's about your own self-image, but also their self-image, and they feel a little bit more worth on themselves when you dress up for them.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. It's like you're projecting that to them. Like is it almost like a confidence thing? Does that seem right? Like
well, I think it's a little bit of confidence, but it's also showing I put something on for you.
Right.
And I think I'm here because I respect you. Mm-hmm. I can tell you when I'm interviewing people and people come and they're wearing jeans and they're slumping or they don't even take their hat off. Right away I'm wondering.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't mean you have to wear a suit and tie to come and do an interview with us, but I do. I want to know that you can put on the fancy.
Right.
Yeah. I had this, I had a college tennis coach who always made a point of ensuring that everyone knew it was a no-go to have the shirt and tie with the short sleeve dress shirt. Does anyone have a policy on that? I mean, go, no go?
Only if you're in a band, I guess.
Right.
If you play rock and roll, then you got a short sleeve.
I've done it a number of times.
Right. Right.
I can't say I'm, a good source for that either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. It always surprised me. Like, it was something he was really against. Uh-huh. Like, it came up again and again. And I was like, did you have a traumatic experience related to that? Were you forced to wear those at some point? But he was just like, yeah, never ever do that. I was like, okay, got a coach.
My reaction is remembering my dad wearing white pants, white belt, and white shoes.
Oh, yeah.
That, I'm not going there.
After August.
Oh, no. After Labor Day. Anytime. Yeah. Should not be worn anytime.
No. Wow.
Right. Again, unless you're in a band, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But,
I guess the right band that could work.
Yeah. I was also going to ask you about the New Columbia, because that's where you've been for a while before you came back to the Cycling Center. You spent some time there working on a really innovative business venture, right?
Yeah, that was exciting. And as I'm recalling the course of this year, I'm reminded that I was actually there earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent about 20 months helping to launch the Village Market out there in New Columbia. Really exciting project. And the exciting things about it, gosh, I mean, it was one of these things that was extremely challenging, extremely rewarding, and also something that I would definitely do again. But I really cherished the opportunity to get out there and connect with people day to day on a really personal, really kind of intimate level. And we have offices, people work places, but to spend every day on the corner of Trenton and Newman in the middle of New Columbia was an amazing opportunity.
Yeah, New Columbia is it's a relatively recent development. I'm trying to remember how long it's been around. I mean, it's been at least 10 years now since it went in.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a low-income housing district in a way for trying to reimagine what low-income housing could look like, I think, when it went in. And they've done a fantastic job. Like the streets are really well laid out up there. The environment, it feels good. It doesn't feel like, with all love to our neighbors east of 205, it doesn't look like east of 205.
Sure.
Where, the automobile is the dominant thing, and, the streets are four lanes wide. And,
right.
And there's no, store you can walk to or whatever. But you were working on this market in hopes of kind of making part of that happen, having food available within walking distance.
Yeah, because before that, there was a food desert. There wasn't anything within 5 miles of the grocery store. And even now, there isn't another cash register in a mile around the grocery store. Mm. And we have to understand this within a fundamental needs hierarchy that let's pretend like we just got food, clothes, shelter squared away in what is, in terms of square mileage, the nation's largest affordable housing campus, right? And they got mixed income, so it's homeowners, people that are renting, multifamily, all of that, along with the support of the folks at Home Forward. They've been able to provide a lot of the space needed, classrooms and community education centers out there, which is great. Good connections with the parks. They got a Boys and Girls Club. Portland Parks and Recreation has a rec center over there, and the Boys and Girls Club is actually connected to an elementary school. And when I was working at the Cycling Center in 2011, I had an opportunity to participate in some of the planning processes for launching the grocery store, and they took 18 months to really vet that plan and get buy-in and comments from the community. And I fell in love with the project and the people out there. And when they were struggling to really get it started out of the gate there, although I wanted the job right out of the gate, they actually decided to go with people that knew something about running a grocery store.
There we go.
And they ended up not being able to keep those folks around. Mm-hmm. And I was one person I think that was stupid enough to give it a go and then stubborn enough to stay with it. And it's nice to know that it's profitable now, and that if you go out there and check it out, 4632 North Trenton Street, you'll find one of these little local gems. And it has been one of the best kept secrets in Portland, but it's the kind of model that is going to be able to provide ongoing support for community groups there in New Columbia for years to come.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Thanks for doing that. Thanks for being involved. And it's nice to see that continue. The Community Cycling Center was also involved with a little project out in the New Columbia as well involving bikes, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're doing three big things out there right now. One, we're supporting a local active transportation and bicycle riding group called We All Can Ride. And that was something that came right from the grassroots there, is led by community members and is continued to be led by community members. And there was actually a meeting just this afternoon with some of the folks and with the support of some of our staff. We also recently helped, with the aid of a design school, do like a 72-hour design build for transportation and bicycle repair hub out there. So we got something that's about, 400 or 500 square foot, really tiny footprint, really awesome piece of infrastructure, and it looks cool, and it wasn't really expensive to build. And that's right next to a bicycle skills park that we built out with the partnership that we have with Northwest Trails Alliance. So it was originally going to be a pump track, and I was really excited about like the fact that we were going to be able to have like a complete pumpable circuit where you didn't have to pedal at all. But inevitably, we decided to go with the skills park, which was going to be more approachable for a lot more kids and allow them to build some of the skills that they need in order to ride bikes safely.
There we go. Yeah, because the pump track, that's basically the idea that you get on your bike and then you just kind of like ride it without a lot of effort.
Yeah, well, with effort, but without having to pedal.
Yeah. But momentum, like you can push that momentum into like infinite loops almost and whatnot.
Yeah, which is exciting and great for kids when they need something to do, right?
Yeah. Sure. So a skills park, the difference is... not a circuit.
Yeah, not a circuit. You got teeter totters. You got banked corners with 2x4s. There's places in there where you got rocks. It helps kids build some of those riding skills because I heard with the last kind of delegation that we had come back from the Netherlands, Jonathan Moss was given a report back at one of these metro meetings, and he talked about how people in other places and people in the Netherlands. They could ride safely, they could ride stylishly, but they're also really skilled, right?
Yeah.
And because they were riding a lot closer together and the riders had a lot of skill, it allowed them to be more social. And now all of a sudden, you got kind of a real different approach fundamentally to what it means to use a bicycle in the right-of-way.
Yeah, and that makes a big difference. Like, just I take for granted the number of skills it takes to ride a bike safely. Because at a certain point, you stop thinking about it after you've been riding for years.
Yeah, there's so much years. I take for granted.
Yeah.
Cycling that is becoming apparent to me as I introduce, like, you know, our, for lack of a better term, German exchange student in the house, you know, into biking around town and realizing, you know, I have to communicate with others, like, where I'm going, but also how much balance and how much, I don't know, just body mechanics goes into maintaining yourself upright.
Totally.
I think bicycling is really easy, so I'm a little confused by this because there's things that we need to watch out for, but in its essence, it's not a very complicated skill once you learn balance.
And once you learn. But
once you get up, right? I mean, sure. And then, but our challenge, I think, in today's world and what the Europeans have figured out, it certainly in Copenhagen and Amsterdam have figured out, is you got to create that place that's safe so that if you make a mistake, you're not going to die.
Well, right. And I think that's maybe part of what I'm taking for granted here.
Right. It's that sharing. They're sharing that space with some very, very difficult, very fast vehicles that
To me, like,
may not be paying the same kind of attention to what they're doing than you are, even though driving a car is much more complicated than riding a bike.
And dangerous.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to me, I mean, I didn't really get into cycling until... No, it's cool. It makes me sort of restate or better state what I was trying to say. Mm-hmm. I didn't really get into cycling until I came here. And so I guess got most of my skills riding alongside of traffic, and so like that's some of the things that I take for granted is how nerve-wracking it is for somebody who doesn't bike alongside traffic, you know.
I remember the first time I did it, can be. And what helped was I had someone just come with me and just talked me through it and said, okay, you're gonna do this and you're gonna feel that. It culminated in me riding a bike around the Champs d'Elysees or whatever that arch thing is in Paris.
Oh, there we go.
And he's like, yeah, we're going to do it. Just going to go right in. And I'm like, I thought I was going to die. And just, you realize after a while, when you get to that point in biking, that if you're confident and you're safe, in many cases, the cars will avoid you. And that confidence sort of exudes out from your bike. And they're like, they see you, they deal with it. And one of the things that we face in this crazy environment that we have here in Portland and in other cities with all these different folks that are biking is the real confident bicyclists might not even pay attention to a red light and go zip through, but they know exactly what they're doing. It's when the other people react to them. That's not when you're in a city like, well, you know, like in Amsterdam, where you've got all these folks, biking real close to each other, one little mistake and, you know, seven of them go down.
Okay. Yeah. That
and they get
sense.
Really mad. They get really mad. If you're not biking in good form.
Like if you betray the social order.
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess just like the idea that if there's a place that people can learn the basic idea, like if you've got the skills park at New Columbia, say where people can just get used to being on a bike. Cause I remember hearing about in Boston, I don't know if it still exists, but there used to be a place that would teach adults how to ride bicycles. Because some people get to full adult stage and never get onto a bike. They've never had the experience. And but like you say, Rob, I think it's not hard and it's not difficult, but especially that first psychological hurdle of getting onto a bike, especially getting onto a bike and going onto the street, can be big. So anyway, I don't even know. I was probably building to something, but all that to say, bikes are good and getting people to learn how to ride bikes is good.
Can we talk a little bit about bike parking? Because I know Chris Smith just had that kind of wonk night. I think that was last week. The days are running together for me. But
yeah.
One thing that struck me as I studied some of bicycle culture out there in the Netherlands and other places is that one of the things that allows for the level of ridership that they have out there is the fact that people have a first mile bike, a last mile bike, and a train in between. And I'd love for us to explore some of the reasons why we don't have more progression in our bicycle parking infrastructure at some of our fundamental and highly trafficked transportation hubs. And how come we don't have some of these crazy bicycle trees? How come we don't have 3- and 4-decker bicycle parking out there? And aside from the fact that the policy states you only have to have like 8 staple racks every time you have a MAX station or something ridiculous, you know, what more are we going to be able to do to help provide for the kind of ridership that they may take for granted in other parts of the world?
Yeah.
Well, one reaction to that is I think we don't have the same kind of density that a lot of European cities have. And density drives a lot of land use and transit and mobility. And And we're not encouraging density necessarily, maybe some cases in part of our transit-oriented development, but I think we can do a lot better in terms of encouraging that density, and that will help with that. We also have a very slow transit system, and it's light rail. It's not fast rail. So in many cases, once you're on that bike, you wonder whether you should get off because it may be slower. And the capacity is a big issue in terms of where you're carrying it. I think what is going to change dramatically for us is when bike share launches next spring. And it's going to launch. We've got some good news coming really short that it's launching. And that's going to provide that opportunity for the first and last bike. Or maybe it's your so that you take that train, or maybe you bike to the station. Once you get to your workplace, you're going to have a bike share available. I think that's going to dramatically change it, just the way it's been changing things in Washington, D.C., Chicago, New York.
Do you think there's also sort of a philosophical block to more bike parking? I know, like...
No, I don't think it's a philosophical block. I think there's some things that we're seeing here that you might not see in Europe is people bringing their bikes inside, particularly because we have larger buildings and larger space inside.
All right.
And secondly, that you don't see... people are much more afraid here of theft.
Certainly.
I was thinking about theft, actually. That was the biggest problem with first mile, last mile, is leaving a bike somewhere. Because either you have a bike that's way too expensive to leave out, like you don't want people to steal parts off of it or try and steal the whole thing. Or like that cost or the assumption of that cost will even keep you from having one. So, yeah. There was the new... Bike Portland just had an article this last week, I think, about that company that is selling a city bike for $550. It's a flat
made in
black.
Detroit.
Made in Detroit. That was
Detroit
it, yeah.
Bikes. That's the Detroit. Company.
Okay, there we go. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
All right.
And
go Detroit.
Now there's two companies along with Shinola. That's
right. Shinola's doing that.
Yeah. Most of their bikes right now are built, I believe, in Wisconsin, but they're doing the finishing in Detroit.
Yeah, what did Shinola do before they made bikes? I should know this.
So Shinola is owned by the same people who make this wallet. What's the name of it? So Shinola is the brand of bike, but it's a company that has other stuff. So they're doing leather goods, wallets, bags, things like that. Okay. And they're making their own seats out of that. It's a beautiful bike.
Yeah, yeah. Leather is nice. Just the idea that like you can get a really quality made bike, not just like a department store special or whatever, something that's going to fall apart and can't be worked on very well or isn't worth working on, but that, you know, for about $550, you can get a bike that it's expensive enough and good enough, well built enough to get you around the city and do the things that you hope it can do for you, but not so expensive that like, you know, that you can't leave it outside somewhere. You can't like lock it to a staple rack or something. So
it'll be interesting to see how it goes, because in Detroit, it makes sense. It's a 3-speed.
Right.
And I had a 3-speed here. And I mean, I know there are people in fixed gears and riding single speeds here, but I struggled with a 3-speed. I needed a little more.
Yeah.
Particularly if you're not a new rider. So in terms of an access point. I mean, you go to a place in Europe or Japan, and there's just so many bikes and they all look the same. Mm-hmm. They're all like this black bike that just is out there. The value of the bike is different, but people are not owning cars. They're not owning other things because of density and the expenses of renting a car. It's, in some ways, it's hard to compare Europe to here. But you can compare other cities to here that are doing some really exciting bike parking things. It's going to take some capital. We've talked about putting in a bike station or asking for a bike station in certain locations. The attempt by TriMet to put bike parking, high density bike parking, in 3 of their transit centers has been met with mixed success.
Right.
But that isn't about the bike parking. It's about what do you do when you get your bike out into that suburban location, and where do you go?
Right.
So connections are really, really important.
Yeah. Getting people from one place to another, it seems like it should be simple, and yet it's surprisingly complex. The transit station out in Beaverton was the one that had that enormous bike station. It was like a big locked cage
with the
access key, and three at Beaverton or were there?
No, there's one at Beaverton,
locations? Okay,
one at Sunset, and I think the third is Hillsboro, or maybe it's Gateway.
Okay.
No, I don't think it's Gateway, but there's been plans. And one of them I forget which one. I think it might have been Sunset. Was not overly successful.
Okay, yeah, and that's what I remember.
And if you look at that, it's interesting because Sunset is an interesting station. It is very hard to bike there. And lots of hills all around, and you have to cross a freeway to get to one side. So it just has all these barriers. So yeah, we were worried about that.
It seems like the wrong place to put it.
It was, but there was an opportunity, and an opportunity with the building of it. So they wanted to focus on the transit centers. There's only a few of those transit centers. Yeah, or Orenco Station, where Intel is, would make a lot of sense.
Sure, right? Yeah.
But they didn't have the space or the parking lot there because it wasn't a transit center.
Right. Speaking of Orenco, it's my hands down my favorite suburb if I was going to live outside of Portland, like outside of the actual city and somewhere else in the metro area. Orenco Station has got some really great urban design as far as like businesses on the bottom, apartments on top, that sort of thing. You don't see building that dense in a lot of places. So I do like what I've seen happening out there. I've always kind of had a little crush on Orenco. I'd probably move there.
And do you know they have a sausage truck there?
Do they? I'm sold. I am sold. Yeah. The other thing I was thinking of, just speaking of barriers, the Community Cycling Center, Michael, has been doing some work on cultural barriers and what is it that keeps people from riding. I was reading through the brochure that came out a while back about that. But yeah. Where are you folks at this point? I know the studies have been done and the some of the work has begun as far as trying to do awareness and find out who needs a bike, who doesn't have one, who doesn't ride one because they don't think they can or whatever. But what does that look like for you guys right now?
Well, it's great. I'm glad that you mentioned it. One of the things I always try to quiz people on that I'll just go ahead and put on the podcast is the often overlooked but most important piece of information that came out of that project was the fact the leading barrier to bicycling was actually having a bicycle. We also found that barriers to bicycling were culturally specific, and in that way, we were able to help inform active transportation advocates all over the region and to an extent all over the country, if not affirm things that they already knew or things that they may have already assumed about why people don't choose to ride bikes and what things you could do to help ensure that people do have that choice and that opportunity. And I think at the most abstract level, there is a great need for a reframing of the conversation around active transportation. And as I get an opportunity to connect with advocates, as I get an opportunity to connect with community members and just everyday people here in the city of Portland, I always try to remind folks that the difference between a car-free community and a community that's considered to be active transportation dependent is privilege and choice. Mm-hmm. And it's, do you have the privilege to live close enough to a job that's going to pay you well enough that will allow you to take care of your family and provide for them and your children? And are you going to be able to get there on a bike? Mm-hmm. Or do you have to wake up earlier, have greater demands, a different set of needs, and have to go farther for a job that pays you less proportionately? And what does that do to your choice architecture and your needs hierarchy as an individual, as a breadwinner, as a person that's a part of a family? And for those of us that live within 3 to 5 miles of the center city and live and work and play in that same zone, it's a lot easier to feel good about being car free, right? Mm-hmm. And just doing this active transportation thing. And why doesn't everybody do this?
Yeah.
Right. Well, it may not be their privilege or it might not be presented with their choice. Yeah. Right. And I think that we need to find ways of reframing that as we approach prioritizing active transportation projects, because it is well documented and continues to be so that the places where you have the highest rates of active transportation mode share are in the places where people suffer disproportionately from poverty. And when you look at the places where people suffer from a lack of abundance, you're going to find that that doesn't feel great. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel great to be classified as transit dependent or as active transportation dependent, right? There's no choice in that. There's no privilege in that. That narrative needs to be reframed from the outside and from the inside out. And there's a lot more that we need to do in order to help people share the beauty of choice and help to share how active and green and healthy folks can be when they decide to choose to walk, to ride a bike, or to ride the bus.
Yeah. And choice has to be there, right? Like it's you have to have the possibility. Like you were talking about people that have jobs that are so far away that it's not tenable to
right.
to walk or bike or take right. a bus. Or,
and it might not be safe. I mean,
right.
you don't have to go too much farther than the single parent that has to stand in a ditch on the side of the road at 5:30 in the morning to wait for a bus that doesn't arrive as frequently as it should, that is costing more and more year after year, to go to a job that may be paying less and less on a regular basis, to know how much they may feel valued by those that are in a position to do something about it. And we have a responsibility to provide access to active transportation and provide opportunities for people to advocate on their own behalf when we're dealing with those kind of situations, because that's the only way that we're going to be able to see any real change. And I hope that we can find that we're going to see one of the greatest returns on our overall investment as a society if we're able to focus on those places that actually suffer from some of the greatest challenges. You know, you only have to hear this statistic once to remember it. And I heard this from Nicole Maher at the Northwest Health Foundation the other day, and she reminded us that 83% of single mothers of color in the United States survive below the federal poverty line. Mm-hmm. 84%, 83%. I can't recall, but fundamentally, that's a big deal.
It's a lot,
and that's not even a big deal for just those moms. It's a big deal for their kids, mm-hmm. And the kind of early childhood that those kids are going to have and their trajectory for the rest of their life. And we need to find a way not only to keep those mothers connected to the workforce, but we need to make sure that they're going to be able to have active transportation options that are going to work.
Mm-hmm. And the classic old-time bicycle advocate would have said, well, if that woman was just biking, she could save money because she wouldn't have to pay for gas. And that righteousness, that that high horse certainly doesn't play well, doesn't speak to her choices, nor to her value system or to value what it's all about. And so part of, I think, what the study that the Community Cycling Center did helped open up a lot of people's eyes to say it's not just about providing choice, but it's the language that we use. It's the way we go about our work. It's the listening skills that we may or may not be using that all play into developing relationships and partnerships that are going to make us move forward. It's not just have a bike.
Right. Right.
I think some of it comes from sort of being unaware that how privileged we are in our station, choosing to ride a bike. Like it's a whole different thing to choose to ride a bike versus, like, again, giving a bike to you and saying, like, here, ride this. This is going to be so much better for you. It could be from the greatest sort of most magnanimous kind of heart, but it's still like having somebody like sort of shove this bike upon you or anything really, really does not feel good.
No. And I think back to why I started riding a bike to work. I was living in Chicago. I had a choice. I could take the train, which took me 45 minutes, or I could drive my car. It took 45 minutes, but I had to pay. Sometimes I had to wait a little while for my car to get out of the parking lot. And a friend of mine says, you should bike. It'll take you 45 minutes. And first of all, I didn't believe him at all. First time I biked, I think it took me an hour and 15 minutes. But after a while, it took me 37 minutes to bike to work. And that's no matter when I left, no matter what the traffic was. So I continued to do it. Because one, it made me feel better. My asthma went away. And two, it was faster than the other two models. It had nothing to do with political choice. It had nothing to do with social choice. In fact, I would almost eschew some of my friends who were car free because they were this judgmental group that I didn't want to be around.
Yeah.
And that's how I came to it. And I can remember, it's like people are going to come to it in different ways and remember what that value to me is. We did some interesting polling recently that we're going to hear about tomorrow at a presentation. That we asked people to look at photographs, look at words and images and just concepts around what they valued, both in terms of facilities on the street like bike lanes and types of bike lanes as well as bikes. And the two things that registered in this, with the focus groups were both in Portland and San Francisco. And the two things that really registered was personal health choice and value in terms of wealth. If they felt that by riding a bike, they could identify themselves with the wealth crowd, no matter what their race, gender, or background was, that was something positive. Showed them pictures of people, wealthy people riding bikes, not necessarily a full kit, but in that sort of experience of within a cultural context that they could understand, they said, oh, I can value that. But if you showed a picture of, I don't know, show a picture of you,
Aaron Flores
with, you know, wearing all black with a, with a keffiyeh around, it's not going to necessarily give them any kind of connection to
it. No, certainly not.
Yeah. And it was interesting. It crossed gender, it crossed race. People want, and that's why people buy a car. That's why people want to buy a house. Sure. They want to feel as if they're successful.
Right.
But at the same time,
I mean, yeah, look at any car commercial. That's totally what they sell you is like, you know, you're going to feel great. You're going to feel successful when you drive one of our machines.
Unless they're selling a minivan or a Subaru or Volvo, and then they're going to sell safety.
Safety. Right. Yes. Or utility. Sure.
It crumples well. It crumples very well.
Are there bike commercials on television anywhere?
I have never seen any.
They can't, you know, we've asked the industry questions like that. Well, they're selling, you're selling more bikes than cars. They're selling more bikes than other shit that's sold on television. Why aren't they utilizing it? And for some reason, they don't see it as a value. And it's kind of interesting.
Intriguing.
And you look at where bike advertisement is in bike magazines. You don't necessarily pick. Maybe you can pick up the Portland Mercury and see a River City ad. But you don't really see. It just kind of happens.
I mean,
It seems like they could blow it out a little bit more by taking that.
Yeah, can we all get like a, you know, chip in and see if we can get it in between weather reports and, you know, get Matt Safino involved or Selesky or somebody?
Super Bowl commercial at some point.
Right.
It just shows you riding a bike, being awesome, feeling awesome, feeling wealthy, I guess, if the study is correct. Right. And yeah.
Yeah, but for some reason, I mean, you've got these companies that are competing. You've got Trek and Giant and Rally and all these companies trying to compete for like the number one brand. You'd think that they'd try it. But for some reason, they haven't.
Right. Well, only people with bikes want to buy other bikes, apparently. So, yeah.
Well, you know the best number of bikes to own, right?
Tell me.
N plus one.
Oh, there we go.
N being the number of bikes you currently own.
Perfect. Perfect. That's what listener Drew actually kind of had. That's my phone.
Aaron,
do you want to press the button that shuts him up? Thank you. Sorry about that, guys. That's why I do light editing on some of these shows. We'll see if this makes a cut or not.
So I'm thinking about buying a new bike.
New bike or new to you?
I don't know.
Because I got a bike for you.
So here I'm trying to decide whether this is going to be my midlife crisis. My commute may be going from 2 miles to 5 miles. So I'm thinking of moving to North Portland.
Uh-huh.
And I'm thinking, do I just want a bike because I want it? Do I want it because it's this midlife crisis and this change in my life that's happening? And so I'm thinking, do I want to build a bike? And I met with one of our local builders, and the sticker shock was unbelievable.
I bet.
We average $6,500 to $10,000.
That's a lot.
And I'm like, that's a big midlife crisis. And
still cheaper than a Corvette.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. But if I had a Corvette,
right.
Think how I feel. I'd feel wealthy.
You'd feel awesome. Right.
So I'm still thinking about it. I'm also thinking about, you know, maybe one of those Shinolas from Detroit, because I have this Detroit connection. That would be cool. That would be about $2,500 for what I want. Or maybe I go in and just walk into the community cycling center, get the kind of frame that I want, and then start building a rack system around it.
Michael is nodding.
Yeah,
yes.
He's ready for me. Yeah.
Yeah, we can pull that off. But if you go with the Detroit one, not a lot of hills between North Portland and the offices downtown. I mean, the toughest climb you got is on your way home back over the Broadway Bridge, really.
Yeah, well, I find that hard to climb sometimes. So
fair enough.
I have an 8-speed right now, and I feel like I need a little bit more oomph, but I'm also in a very upright bike, and I think it's more getting into that position. It's style. It's like, do I want a bike that anyone else can buy, or do I want someone to build it, or, you know, just that kind of funness of it.
Yeah.
Plus, I just love of obsessing about that next buy.
Yeah.
Man, I know what you mean. I'm really excited about trying in one of these e-bikes. I don't know if you guys have been to Wakefield's new shop over there.
I saw that he moved. I saw when the shop that he used to be in closed. This is Wakefield Greg from the e-bike shop. He used to be up on North Williams in Alberta.
Yep.
And So at one point, it just emptied out the building. It was all empty. And I was like, did he close? And I thought, I was really hoping he didn't, because I was really glad he was in business. And it turns out he is somewhere else. Where
does
he?
He's kitty corner from Peninsula Park. So he's actually on the corner of Albina and Rosa Parks.
Okay.
Oh, great. No kidding.
Yeah. No, great space. And he's got this cool little closet in there where he's got like a lathe. And I think he's getting ready to put in a CNC machine. Everything that he needs to do all of his crazy science projects.
That's fantastic.
And do some really kind of one-off fabrication projects. Really awesome stuff.
Yeah, we got to get him in sometime to talk about e-bikes. So,
when you go into a big bike shop, do you sometimes feel like you're in a candy store?
No. it's like any other kind of situation. Well, first, because I can't ever, never mind. Well, it's just like for the 20 months or whatever that I was away from the cycling center, I bought absolutely nothing because I cannot. Once you're in the industry, it is really hard to pay retail. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Oh, yeah. And then even in like grocery industry now, I can see like how much a 40-pound box of Tangelos costs. And I'm like getting ready to go down Pacific Coast Fruit and just will call it, you know, because I don't want to pay retail. It's bad. But walking into Wakefield's shop and seeing like, he's got like this e-bike bus. He's got this thing that's got a cockpit on it. He's got all of these other kind of hybrid models. And I'm just like, oh, yeah, I want one of those, you know.
So what would that cost me?
Well, less than the bike you were talking
less
about.
Less than a Joe Aaron built up.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, he's got some really cool stuff.
And he can paint it any color I want?
I'm pretty sure. And if not, then you could just, you know, strip it, take it to one of these places. Just powder coat it, man.
Perfect. Well, it sounds like we have a solution to the problem.
And I guess really what I want is I want a generator hub, which I have on my bike now, but I want to replace the light on the generator hub so I can plug so it has that port, the USB port, so that I can charge my phone.
Do they make those? Yeah.
They have, they're okay. Out already.
Okay. Because I need one of those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like bad.
Yeah.
Seriously.
We'll hook you up later.
Okay.
You have a connection.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
And you could trickle feed it, like when you're riding and you're doing your touring, you can just like charge everybody's phone or have run speaker systems off of it, and have music playing the whole time.
I would really like that.
Yeah, I just bought a solar powered charger, so I can do that on my bike.
Nice.
And now I'm thinking, I might not have bought that if I knew that I could have got this light. But on the other hand, it's really cool to have a solar charger that charges my phone.
Right. Well, and then you don't have to ride if you don't want to.
Right.
You can just lay
camping,
in the sun
and just
let it charge.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you're at the lake.
What does sun look like?
We've all forgotten.
It's already.
In the winter. Yeah. The one thing I'm always excited about every year, Michael, when the Community Cycling Center does the kids bike drive.
Yeah.
And that is kind of coming up, right? Like
absolutely.
Coming around Christmas time or thereabouts, other holidays as well. The donations, of course, are always welcome. If you have an old bike that you're not using or you know of an old bike, CCC will fix those up and get them ready for kids, right?
Absolutely. We're going to provide and have provided for years now over 500 kids an opportunity to get their first bike.
Yeah.
And it's a really, really powerful experience and a really wonderful event. And we've worked to incorporate safety education as part of that process over the years. But this is a great opportunity if you're out there in podcast land to get onto the Willamette Week Give Guide site and take an opportunity, check out the BTA, check out the Cycling Center, read up, share with your friends, and make sure that you can make a donation to help support our winter campaigns.
Yeah, and this is what you were talking about with one of the barriers being like you don't have a bike.
Right.
And especially with your life story about like you grew up riding bikes and you got into it because you did it with your family.
Yeah.
So if any of you out there and any of us in here can help someone else get a bike, that's a really powerful thing. So,
or if you want to volunteer, I'm volunteering. I just volunteered today to be there. It's December 8th. This year is the holiday drive. Yeah. And it's just great to see the smile on the kids. So there's all these jobs. You can fit helmets. You can help run a bike rodeo. If you have language skills, particularly if you have like Spanish, Russian, or other language skills and to translate, it's really needed. And it's a great just opportunity to see kind of what this experience is for the kid, for the family. The whole family goes through this line. They learn about bike safety. They learn about helmet safety. And then at the end, they get a bike, and then they get to take it out on this little rodeo. And it's just, it's probably one of the most happiest moments to be a part of.
Yeah.
That well, first bike experience. Yeah.
I've never been at the event itself, but I've always seen the pictures in news articles and whatnot. It's so damn inspiring. So that's it's a good thing. Got to keep that going.
You should come out and volunteer.
I should.
The food is amazing for volunteers.
You know how to get me.
Yeah.
It's like barbecue and pizza. It's really great.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm there.
How about barbecue pizza?
I don't know. Maybe.
Maybe.
I barbecue pizza.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
Perfect. Okay. So
always back to food with Bob.
So it's the communitycyclingcenter.org. Is that? Okay. Yeah. Uh-huh. And you guys are a nonprofit. You go on donations. So anything anyone can do to help is always appreciated.
Yes.
Check that out. BTAOregon.org.
Yep.
Yes. And also, I actually just became a small member, I'll say, but a recurring donor to the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, mostly because I knew I was going to see you again. Wonderful. And if we want to keep you coming on the show, I don't think I could, in good conscience, keep having you come back and not donate to the organization you're in charge of. So
we really appreciate it. We think it's kind of like, you know, you wouldn't ride without a seat. You shouldn't ride without BTA membership. Plus, it gets you a discount to bike shops. You can get 10% off a lot of bike shops, including Community Cycling Center, which is a discount partner. Right.
And
you'll save your money.
Which we all know paying retail is for suckers.
That's right. Can't do that. And both of your organizations are working on these issues we were talking about, like trying to close the gap for the people who have and the people who don't have as far as access to transit and active transportation. So
we approach it from different perspectives with different you know, we all want the same thing.
Right.
But we know you can't just do it in one way, and we can't be everywhere, and they can't be everywhere. Their Community Cycling Center is much more rooted solidly in a community. They're much more grassroots from that perspective, and we're a little more grass tops. But you can't have policy change. You can't have money to build the things on the street without that policy work. So, yeah, to me, it's like, why not? You need to support both. I support the Community Cycling Center. Michael supports the BTA. And
you got to water the lawn. You got to cut the lawn.
Yeah.
Both ends.
If you have grass.
And everybody wants grass.
I think so.
I think that's what we learned today. You guys have a couple minutes to go over a couple news articles with us?
Sure.
All right. Fantastic. Yeah. Well, let's have a look at our headlines. And do you want to do mail or headlines first? Either way, we should blaze through these because we got only so much time.
True.
We're busy people talking to even busier people.
I've got mail up first.
Okay. So. Yeah, you do. You've got this. This?
We got mail.
Yeah, you do.
Hey, we got mail.
This is Aaron doing a thing that will haunt him for the rest of his life.
For the rest of my natural life and probably into some of the afterlife.
Probably so.
At least the first 1,000 years. So from Tim from DC, he donates. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks, Tim. Appreciate it.
And says, plus one on the rain cape. I particularly like them for those steamier rainy days in the summer, although I bet they'd rock the colder, wetter PDX winters, too. Yeah,
I'm a big rain cape believer. I have,
really?
Two.
Okay, I was going to ask, do either of you guys use rain capes?
I don't even use a rain jacket.
Okay.
Say what?
Well, that's because you're a badass, sir. That's, no that's shit. What you do.
When it's raining hard, when it's raining light, I don't use a rain cape. But when it's raining hard, and it's nice because they got these loops on my fingers so that it goes over my handlebars.
And it stays
so when it's cold,
hands.
My hands stay dry.
Oh, snap.
And my legs stay dry, and generally I don't have to wear rain pants and get into that. I overheat, so you can hold it up. It's not that – you don't have that – it's not like wearing saran wrap.
Okay.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Which a rain jacket always feels like to me.
The thing that always holds me back from something like that is just the flapping in the wind.
I thought you were going to say, can I get it in black?
Yeah. Well, and that too, of course. I just assume you could get one in black.
I think if not, the cycle, you probably could get it in black.
I'm done.
But. You can. I don't have one, but when I tried one on in Germany, they had a tie down in the back.
Wow.
Okay. No kidding.
Yeah. Huh.
Interesting. Yeah. And Michael, do you wear a rain jacket?
Not really.
Do you wear?
So you just show up?
No,
wet?
Sometimes I show. I mean, I just wear whatever it was that I'm wearing in the day. Like I got a wool sweater, but it's kind of silly. But you never really have to go very far, and
right.
then it's this kind of balancing act between: am I just going to get sweaty on my way to where I'm going?
Totally.
And would I rather just have that be rain?
And
like I'm really totally okay with rain. There are times when it's just like sopping wet and awful outside, but I find that if I'm sitting in a meeting for about an hour. I'm usually dry by the time it's done anyway.
Usually dry, yeah. Exactly, so, yeah. I like that approach.
That it just blew my mind.
Depends on the day for me. It depends on how much it's raining and how far my ride is. Because my ride used to be like a 14-mile commute. It was ridiculous.
Yeah.
And even then, like wearing all of my rain gear, I would get home and be like completely soaked if it was a real soaker of a day.
Yeah.
I really like the idea of like being closer to work and just being able to dart through the rain and be okay with it.
Yeah. So privilege again.
Well, true. Yeah. True. Play. You have to be able to. Yeah. Privileged weather.
Yes.
Jack from Apex, North Carolina says, I would second the cotton balls with petroleum jelly as a fire starter. I keep them in old film canisters. Perhaps you know someone who still uses a 35 millimeter film camera.
Oh, what?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
okay. Luddites.
actually, I have not even a SLR. It's a viewfinder.
Ooh.
Really old style.
Nice. Is that the one with the three-dimensional images?
No. Yes.
That's a ViewMaster.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Hilarious. Okay. No. Like, it's... So you have these sort of like two images that are... It's the same image, but how you can tell that it's in focus is when the two images finally come together as one.
Wow.
Old school.
Yeah.
But at the time it was...
Yeah.
Rocked the world.
Yeah. That thing is built like a tank. I think it was 1960s this camera was built and still going strong.
Yeah. The second half here, it just mentions the magnesium blocks, which a friend of mine showed me one time. Those things are amazing. For starting fires,
I had one as a Boy Scout.
Yeah.
I totally forgot about them.
Magnesium is that metal that you can flake off with a knife, and then like when you spark the knife, it like all lights up in a big blaze. So I gotta get some of that.
Taking matches like a sucker.
Seriously.
Marcus from episode 1
back in the day
43
something like that. Yeah,
maybe
from Chicago.
Shares a link with us to exciting statistics that show bicycles outselling cars in Europe. Also, he is always glad to hear of Aaron and your I guess being you, Brock.
I was trying to figure that out earlier.
Around Portland.
I think he just likes hearing about your adventures in Portland.
Really?
Bicycles are outselling cars here, so why does it... What's his point?
Apparently, I don't know.
Those are just the statistics he sent us.
Unless it's dollar-wise, that would be interesting.
Yeah, I would have to look into that again. I know that apparently the trend has been in Europe that, like, in many, many fronts, multiple markets, multiple countries, that bikes have been outselling. But you're saying here in the U.S. as well?
Yeah,
and
this is the first I've heard about that in terms of unit.
Really?
It was actually on Bike Portland.
Okay.
Earlier today, but this has been for a while.
Gotcha. I haven't read my news yet today. Sorry.
Yeah, because people buy, you know, like me, they buy a lot of bikes, they have bikes for their kids, and
right.
More bikes are sold in the United States than cars, and that's been that way for years.
That's fantastic. That's good to hear.
But you can read Bike Portland's analysis, John's analysis of why that doesn't matter.
Okay.
That was like the subtitle of it.
Interesting.
Like, bikes are outselling cars, but it doesn't matter. It
doesn't matter.
They're still more awesome.
They're still selling cars. I think that's...
Oh, gotcha. The other way. Yes. Okay.
Well, and I imagine dollar amount wise, cars are still...
That's why I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but that's... Yeah.
Right.
I'm going to have to read that article now.
Well, we'll link to both of those then.
Yes.
And hi, Marcus.
He's a good guy.
No,
he bought us beer that one time.
He bought us lots of beer.
Well, actually,
he bought me ginger beer even.
Totally.
Yeah. Anyways, lastly, my coworker or ex-coworker, Sarah from San Francisco, shares with us a video of a guy in New York City who got ticketed for riding outside the bike lane. And so he goes on to tape himself riding in the bike lane no matter what and running into various things. This is actually a video that is about 3 years old.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I can't remember. Back in again.
Yeah.
But
this
brings up something.
He just refilmed based on some of the new systems. Is anything different?
Okay.
So there's kind of like version 2.0.
Well, okay.
Oh, okay. Maybe that was it. Well, it said copyright 2011. But anyhow.
I think there's a new one.
So we'll look for the new one. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
This brings up a good point or an issue I've been having riding is that the bike lanes are full of shit.
Right.
I mean, I know it's fall and there's a lot of leaves out, but come on, get with it, people.
Well, cut to headline number one that I have here is actually the story about the guy
Ashland. Let's go cut to headlines. Thank
who
you.
Was pulled over by a cop that some would say has an anti-bike bias, who was ticketing the bicycle rider in Ashland, Oregon, that's down in southern Oregon, for riding on the white line instead of in the bike lane that was provided. That was, according to the bicyclist, he was avoiding debris. According
Which,
to the
again,
cop,
is
he was
always
dead wrong.
Full of glass.
Yeah.
Bike lanes.
Yeah. But that the article, which I think also is from Bike Portland, it highlighted the controversial nature of Oregon's mandatory side path law, which says that if there is a bike lane or path,
you have to
use
it.
That instead of the road.
As long as
it's
clear.
Safe,
I mean,
and clear. Yeah, exactly.
But so in a court, if he takes him to court, it should be okay.
Yeah.
We at the BTA are always examining and looking for an opportunity to repeal that law. Counting votes to see if we can get the votes to do that.
Okay. Yeah, it's very interesting case. So that made me think of that.
There's a video linked to that, right?
Right. You can watch the whole interaction between the cyclist and the officer.
From the officer's or from the patrol car's camera.
The dash cam or whatever. Yeah.
And the officer just really just digging in his heels and saying, like, nope, that's not good enough.
We've heard there's some officers in the city of Eugene that are looking for an excuse to pull bicyclists all over that are not riding in the bike lane. So
interesting.
No kidding.
All right. So if you live in Eugene, watch out.
Watch it.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to read that headline since we just talked about it.
Exactly. The other ones are more upbeat and exciting.
Sure. Secondly, from Bike Portland, the Portland Mercury now delivered by cargo bike. Michael Hanshin couldn't take any more hours behind the wheel. Quote, "You would never know where there's a loading zone," unquote. The veteran Portland Mercury delivery contractor 42 recalled Wednesday, "I think that's what did me in." Then, after 5 years of delivering the Mercury to inner southwest Portland every Wednesday, Hanshin had a revelation. He'd recently rigged his truck to remove its canopy, replacing it with a homemade contraption that kept the papers dry. But after seeing Soup Cycle and other cargo bike companies around town, he realized he'd been thinking too small. The idea is like, don't take the canopy off, he said. Take the truck off. A few months later, Hanshin is no longer the Mercury's downtown delivery driver. He's one of three downtown delivery trike drivers. It's a deal, Hanshin says, Hanshin and his colleagues say, that speeding deliveries of the free alternative weekly newspaper, improving its marketing to the community, and vastly improving the job of newspaper deliverer. Mercury General Manager Katie Lake said the cost to the company per copy is comparable. Hanshin's truck, meanwhile, stays parked at his house, and he says the stress of his job has evaporated. "I take the bus to do my paper route," Hanshin said, "and that's awesome."
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's pretty great. That's after we just talked to from Beeline, you know, talked about delivered by trike and everything like that a couple weeks ago. And so it's nice to see that taking on steam and expanding into other industries and other companies. I like that a lot.
My first job was delivering newspapers by bike.
No shit.
I've come full circle now.
Yeah. Perfect.
We have come full circle. is this the last? Yeah. Lastly, Yahoo Shine via my brother Dan. Young lady's bike is stolen but replaced by a kind person. Yeah, this was very nice and upbeat.
It was.
When someone stole 19-year-old Olgi Ferrer's beloved bicycle, she didn't just get upset. She publicly posted an angry note to the thief, hoping he would see it. You know, why did they assume it's a guy? That's sexist.
But probably true.
That's profiling. The note, in part, read, "Do you know how hard I worked to buy the bike? Actually, you stole it while I was at work. I'm 19 and paid for that completely out of my own pocket. I work 40 hours a week. I go to school part-time. That bike was my only mode of transportation. So I don't care who you are or where you're from, but you just stole something from a person who dedicates her time to making her life better." That day, a passerby snapped a photo of the note and tweeted it. By the time Ferrer woke up on Tuesday morning, she had dozens of phone calls from local news reporters inquiring about her bike. A news story aired that night and caught the attention of Chicago resident Robert Curry, 59, a senior vice president at Morgan Stanley. I was watching the television and eating a sandwich when I saw a news segment about a girl whose bike was stolen, Curry told Yahoo Shine. My heart immediately went out to her because I was in college. My roommate left the window in our apartment open and a thief stole the $80 and my bike. Sorry. I knew exactly how she felt and wanted to help. Curry wants nothing in return for his gesture, but there's one caveat. I told Olgi that she could have the bike on the condition that before her 59th birthday, she must buy a bike for someone in her shoes. He says she has 40 years to fulfill that promise. That's sweet. Pretty cool.
Pay it forward.
Right.
Damn right.
Yeah, that's a great story. I like that a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I love the detail too. You know, he's in Chicago, you know, he's watching the television, he's eating a sandwich, you know. That's great imagery.
As you do, if you're from Chicago.
I was having a sandwich.
Yeah.
Although the only concerning thing about the story that concerns me is that it actually rewarded passive-aggressive behavior.
Ah, gotcha.
Slightly, yeah.
I was talking a little bit about passive-aggressive behavior and how Northwestern that is as a... I mean, I don't know that
I don't
it's
know.
Exclusively
I
Northwestern.
It's global, yeah, I grew up in the Great Lakes area, and it's pretty... permeated in the culture too.
We
yeah.
talked earlier about the superhero of a gear crusher or whatever.
Oh right, yeah.
And then my superhero, if I can be a superhero, would be the superhero that attempts to rid the world of passive aggressive behavior.
Just straightforward man. Yeah. I was riding on Stark
just
the other day.
Tell them what you mean.
There was a guy following us on the ride. We were on our bikes, and there was a guy in a vehicle behind us, a car, and he leaned out the window and said, "You know, there's a bike lane on Ankeny." And I wanted to say two things. Number one, they're Sharrows. It's not a bike lane. Number two, full lane. Allowed full lane.
Oh, Oregon snap. Law. So I mentioned,
yeah.
I mentioned how often I ride up and down Hawthorne and other busy streets. I was coming up Hawthorne. You know where that Safeway is?
Uh-huh. That
up
new on one. That,
up on
the shiny hill. One. Yeah,
yeah. yeah.
The new old one.
That's true. Used to be old. Now it's new and shiny.
This dude laid on his horn right behind me. He was like inches behind me.
Mm.
And... I'm sorry, Rob. I just went just slightly slower in my lane.
Passive aggressive.
Yep.
Well, no, it's actually taking action. There's a little bit of action there.
Direct but action.
Not completely passive.
That's true. Maybe it's just aggressive.
Yeah.
Just not talking, which, again, the system is built so we don't have to talk to each other.
That's true.
Which is part of the problem. Well, hey, this has been a good show. Thank you again both for coming in. And I'm going to roll the theme music and we're going to be like, done.
Hit so, this mother.
Yes, indeed. Thanks, everybody.
Don't hit your mom.
Don't.
Find us on the internet at thesprocketpodcast.com. Send feedback about the program and suggestions for topics and or guests and or drinks. Write to us via email. The address is thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com. Or call and leave us a message at 503-847-9774. You can also text us to that number. Connect with us on Twitter at sprocketpodcast. Thanks to Ryan J. Lane for providing our theme music. Find him on the internet at ryanjlane.bandcamp.com. Thanks to Hurt Bird for our headline sounder. Find them at hurtbirdmusic.com.
That's right. Give your money to the Community Cycling Center, MBCA Oregon.
Or volunteer.
Or maybe us.
And brush
or
your
all
teeth.
Three. Yeah, go to bed. Bye.
It's actually, that's my favorite one of the group.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to bash
it. Shut up. If you don't like it, that's more for me.
He first fed them this nectar in a gourd. Basically, it's legalized drug. And he has this whole routine where you like pass the gourd, basically getting paid to market narcotics. And it is now in some university campuses surpassed coffee as the beverage.
I was reading.
No shit. That. You got me going? Oh, yeah.
You got I'm me on, going, baby.
Oh, yeah. I'm on there.
I'm dating myself totally, right?
It's okay.
Actually, that was my sister's.
It's better than me dating you, I'm sure, right?
Yeah. Well, you never know.
Or whatever.
That's yeah.
all right. Yeah. I mean, the mate, it's a gentle flavor already.
You should be drinking it in a gourd.
I should be. Yeah, exactly.
We had friends that spent a lot of time in South America, and they brought the mate tradition with them. And if somebody holds onto the gourd too long, apparently, like in South America, they'll tell you that the mate is not a microphone, and that means you have to like pass it on so other people can keep on enjoying it with you. I've had a lot of mate. For some reason, I don't think it does to me the same thing that it would do to somebody else. Like, I don't notice the effects.
Why do you think that is?
I have no idea. I must be improving.
Do you drink a lot of caffeine?
When I drink caffeine, I drink a lot of it.
I get the sort of the heightened awareness of coffee, but I don't get jittery with mate.
Oh, okay. So that's good. Yeah.
And it has a half-life.
Oh, does it?
Yeah.
Okay. Which means, like...
So it's like...
It stays in you for a long time.
It's very slow decay.
Yeah.
I've never had... I don't think I've ever had anything with a half-life. I've never been aware of the half-life in me. Maybe I've got tons of it.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why. That's why the caffeine doesn't do anything for me. So do you want to wiggle the connection right here and just see if that...
Does it sound bad?
There we go.
Yeah. Oh, I just wasn't talking.
Yeah, either it... Okay, there we go. Never mind.
The connection's fine. The equipment's good. I'm just enthralled. You should have seen it the other day. We were all sitting in Greg Raisman's teepee, and I was sitting there not saying nothing. And then Greg was like, "How you doing over there?" I was like, "Oh, well, it's just amazing people having a wonderful conversation. I don't really want to interrupt that."